was obviously shared yesterday.
I love Gene.
Same.
Gene's my guy. But he's
good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Today's Wednesday, April the 8th. Got a lot of bills on our agenda committee, and as you've noticed, there's been quite a flurry of amendments appearing in front of you. Today we have our first public hearing on House Bill 3151. We'll be doing that first, and that hearing will indicate what else we may be doing with that bill today or not. House Bill 2578, we will be going over the amendments to that bill. I'm going to hold off on that one for a little bit, though. And then we will go into 2141 public hearing. And following that, we'll have a public hearing on 2792. And then we may open 2367 just to review the amendments for a moment. My intention may be to move an amendment to House Bill 2141, but we will not be working that bill, nor 2367, nor 2792 today, beyond just adopting amendments. So that's the game plan. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3151. Victoria, could you give us a brief description of this rather short bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3151 modifies requirements for transferor of motor vehicle must meet for liability protection.
Thank you. And up first, we have the pleasure of having one of the bill's chief sponsor, Representative Harker. If you'd like to come up and bring anyone with you that you would like to go over the where's, when's, and why's of the bill.
We will attempt to do that. So.
Welcome to the Consumer Protection Committee this afternoon, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Will do, sir. I'm Chris Harker, representative from House District 34, the Hills and Dales of Beaverton, for the record. Representative Holvey, Chair, and members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here to hear us out on this bill. I'd like to introduce my constituent, Rick Tosh, who is the reason that I introduced this bill. He contacted my office in September of 2008 regarding his having had paid $1,000 in court for a car that was no longer his. I was reading this email at home one evening, and I just couldn't believe this tale he was telling me. So we struck up a correspondence, during which time I learned the facts that he will tell you here. I've asked him here today, and fortunately he was able to do it on relatively short notice, to tell you his story, and then I'll explain how House Bill 3151 will hopefully prevent this type of thing from happening again.
Rick?
My name is Rick Tosh, Representative Holy of the committee. Thank you for hearing this. In 2002, I sold a car. Apparently, 3 years later, it had been towed. I guess I should back up. After I sold the car, I went to DMV and reported that I had sold it. I gave him the paperwork. He typed into the computer, told me I was all clear, and I left. 6 years after I sold the car, I'm all of a sudden being sent to collections for towing charges. The towing company never informed me that they had the car. The towing company never approached me for charges on the car. This all of a sudden, I'm in collections. When the collection agency called me, I told them that I had sold the car 6 years previously. And I sent him a copy of the bill of sale. I sent him a copy of my insurance company's statement that I had discontinued the insurance on the car and started the insurance on my new car on the day that I claimed. He didn't care. He told me that on the phone, that I was still the registered owner, so he didn't care about any of the evidence that I had given him. I assumed that Oregon law would not be as it was. So we went to court. and I sat and watched him with another woman in front of me. She had sold the car as scrap. She had gone to the DMV. But again, DMV still showed her as a registered owner. And the judge ruled in favor of the collection agency. I was at that point horrified. This was an obviously poor woman. The collection agency, right in front of the judge, stated he had no doubt that she had sold the car. That wasn't the question. He had no doubt that she had done everything she was supposed to do. It still had her as the registered owner of the car. So the judge ruled in favor of the collection agency. And then I did the same thing. I went up, showed them all my evidence. It didn't matter. I was the registered owner, and so I lost. At that point, I could afford it. I was outraged, but I could afford it. The fact that this poor woman was put through this and money taken out of her pocket outraged me so much that that's why I'm here. That's why I took time off work, drove down here from Portland, because of what this man is doing to poor people. And if you think about this, it's not going to be wealthy people that are going to be hurt by this. It's poor people that are going to have these old cars, and they sell them, and sometime down the road, it's towed. I guess that's all I've got.
Thank you. I think you laid out a pretty concise explanation of the situation. Appreciate it. Representative Harker.
Chair Holding, committee. As you've just heard, the statute as it is currently written did not protect these law-abiding citizens who seem to fulfill all their legal requirements to complete a transfer of a vehicle. In my office, in consultation with legislative counsel and staff from the Department of Transportation, has proposed the changes to ORS 803.117 that you see before you in House Bill 3151. As Chair Holvey pointed out in the beginning, it is a very compact bill we're looking at. According to the statute, if a transferor has notified DOT of the transfer and signed the title of the transferee, both of which Mr. Tosh did, they have satisfied the requirement which clears them of liability for the vehicle. Unfortunately, the statute as it is currently written also includes the statement, made a bona fide transfer of a vehicle, without providing a definition for the term. In consultation with LC and ODOT, it was decided that this undefined mention of a bona fide transfer led to some ambiguity about what the transfer actually entails. By removing this language, we hope to provide clarity and prevent any future liability to those who have satisfied the requirement of a vehicle transfer. Thank you again for allowing us to be here, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just
attorney.
but don't hate me, just because I'm a lawyer. I really am just trying to understand the bill. So I gather the court in this case found that despite the fact that you notified the Department of Transportation and assigned title, but that was not a bona fide transfer, or that bona fide transfer requires something else, or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, that was what came out of these lengthy conversations, because it was agreed, as I understand it, not having been present in Multnomah County Court at the time that any of this took place, it was agreed that everything had been filed as was required, as stated here, except for this bona fide transfer. It was also alleged or reported to me that the bona fide transfer was in there as a means of permitting some wiggle room in interpretation of the law to deal with vehicles transferred within a family. The law clearly states that, or attempts to clearly state, that what has preceded it, by any reason of the provisions of this code shall not be subject to civil liability or criminal liability for the parking, abandoning, or operation of the vehicle by another person when the transferor has performed these other two details, which he had done.
Representative Harker, I'm curious why ODOT, after being notified of the transfer, still I'm assuming that being the registered owner is registered with ODOT records.
Correct.
So why, after the Department of Transportation had been notified and the title had been assigned, did not the Department of Transportation or DMV remove the original owner from the being the registered owner?
Representative, as it turns out, at the same time I was being sued, my mother has become senile and we had to sell her vehicle. Knowing I didn't want to go through this again, when I went to the DMV with her vehicle, I asked for a receipt as I turned it over. The person behind the desk said he can't give me one. He put the piece of paper in a file and said it has to come here to Salem to be processed. There was nothing he could give me. My guess from that is that that piece of paper, when I took my vehicle in, never got here. It was never processed. So even though I went to the DMV, since it didn't get processed, my name was never taken off. The next owner of the vehicle never went in and did what he was supposed to do.
That's the key.
That's the key. Mindy, I think that that's a key factor here. The transfer, item number two on line 10 is assign the title to the transferee. That was done, but the transferee never followed through. We have a little bit of a weak link here, but because the transferee did not go register the vehicle for whatever reason, Mr. Tosh was the last registered owner of the vehicle.
That remains clear to me. And Representative Widener, question?
Actually, he said what I wanted him to, so because I know somebody else who went through this very same issue, and I think this is a very important bill that we move and pass right away.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not convinced that this change of language will solve the problem.
That's my concern.
I believe that the real problem is in the method we have of completing the transfer. When we require that the person who has received the vehicle go in and notify the DMV of that receipt, and we don't remove the prior owner's name until that happens, that's the problem, not this language. That's my opinion.
We lost our resident lawyer. Representative Cowan.
Well, yes, I'm actually sorry that my legal counsel isn't here. Because I'm feeling redundant now, but that's what's troubling me is I understand the concern you're bringing, and I'm in complete agreement with you. And I know that the problem rests with the fact that people get a vehicle and then they don't go in and go through the necessary paperwork. And you're really confident that this language will solve the problem? I mean, I guess that's my concern, is I too would like to fix this, and I don't know whether this would do it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
In my prior life, as I call it, this wasn't too uncommon to find. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. It's the person who receives that car, buys it, and then doesn't change the registration, and they may not want to do that because they can't do it unless they get insurance. That's why they don't do it. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons they don't do it. So consequently, I'm not certain that this gets you where, you know, I pass this bill out immediately because it is a good bill. It protects people. I think we need to have a look to see whether this really gets us to where we need to go. I'm not certain that it does.
Representative Riley?
One more comment. The other problem with this is by thinking that we're fixing the problem here, which I don't believe we are, what we're doing is we are leaving someone who has expended some sort of work holding the bag. The person who didn't turn in their registration has created a liability and skipped. And yes, we're removing it from this gentleman. We're putting it on the person who did the work, which needs to be paid for. So while I agree that this is a huge problem, I think we need to find a different way to fix it.
Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if we have anybody here from DMV who can help us with this.
I was going to ask that question when we finish with this panel.
Thank you.
I don't see any.
Looks like we do not.
Okay. Any other questions on this particular panel?
He has something else to say.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make one more comment to Senator Representative Riley's comment. As I understood from the paperwork that I got from the collection agency, the towing charge was $130. Mm-hmm. They sold the car at auction for $150. The $1,000 that I was sued for, it was $1,400 and reduced to $1,000, was for parking the car for a month. They got back their money for the towing charges. That was $1,000 to park a car.
Well, I appreciate this bill. I think the sentiment of this committee is to follow up with this bill in another hearing and bring DMV or ODOT into this committee and talk to us about the vehicle code and what their solution to this issue is, because I don't think this bill is apparently satisfying this committee that we're fully solving the issue. I think this is a good start on it, but I think there may need to be an additional couple of statements in here as the committee sort of, I guess, alluded to. So at least we'd like to explore that, Representative Harker. Albeit we do have a little time left on our agenda to deal with this, and I'm confident that we'll give it our best shot. Representative Krieger.
One of the things when you talk to LC, it's obvious that the person who towed the vehicle didn't notify him right away. So he's got the vehicle in possession for 15 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Then he notifies him, because that's how he builds up that parking or storage fee. And he may have a lot of room for a airliner in there and have two vehicles, and it's not costing a darn thing, but it's an excuse to extract fees, and that's the thing that consumer protection needs to go after. You need to go after both of those.
Yeah, I don't know that we have the bill to do that with this, but it'll be...
I got a priority bill we might use.
Okay.
Bring it on.
Okay, Mr. Chair and all members of the committee, thanks a lot for your input. I was hopeful that what we were being told was accurate and sufficiently provided sufficient protection for the folks in this position. I'm not altogether surprised by what we're hearing here. If we can work this to the point where it will really truly provide the coverage that folks in this situation need, I'd be grateful for the opportunity to help do so.
Yeah, certainly I think it's worth this committee exploring that other aspect of this bill. And if we can get there, I think we ought to try to get there. And if we can't, we'll move this on to the other side of the building and give them a shot at it. So,
okay.
With that, I don't know that there's any more questions for you at this point. I appreciate you bringing the issue forward. It looks like a good one that should be relatively simple to solve,
I would
think.
I would think so, sir.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
I just want to reassure Mr. Tosh that the committee is intending to do something, even if it's only this bill, if we can't find something else. And it wouldn't be necessary for you to take another day off work because we hear it again, your story is compelling, and the committee will not forget it.
Thank you for coming down.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, too, for bringing this forward. Next up, I have Mike Wagner. And somebody else. Oh, Dina Kopp? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Mike Wagner. I own Sandy M. Towing up in Lyons. I also own Sandy M. Enterprises, which is an Oregon dealer that sells tow trucks. I'm past chair of the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and I'm currently serving as the board chair for the ODAC committee for DMV. And so I think I bring some expertise that covers, I know the dealer side of this business, and I know the towing side of it, and have some comments I'd like to make. So,
certainly.
I think that the committee is right on when they understand that this isn't going to solve the real root of the problem. This, when it was written originally, was probably a Band-Aid. We're trying to put another Band-Aid on a Band-Aid, and it's probably not going to solve the problem. I'm concerned with this bill that when we say that you notify the Department of Transportation for the transfer, I can tell you, as someone who's in the industry, that most people think that's okay. 30, 60, 180 days, they think that's something you do when you receive a notice in the mail that something's wrong. So state law requires that we notify Department of Transportation within 10 days of a sale. And at the very least, I'd like to see it put in that that people do what they're legally obligated to do and notify within 10 days. It's pretty common practice in our industry that when someone has a legitimate flag on a vehicle, that you don't pursue them in collections. I don't know what the particulars are, what happened there. He should have been notified. We've got safeguards in place under current towing law that in his situation, I would think within 5 business days that we would have had request information within 5 business days, and we would have been mailing shortly thereafter. You know, so he should have been notified well within 15 days that his vehicle was in storage. I don't know why that didn't happen. And it certainly should have under the system that's set up currently. You know, I think there's a public safety issue here. The law enforcement is very concerned in knowing who really owns a car when they're involved with it. The towing industry would love to know who really owns a car so that we can pursue those people that really owe bills. You know, I think DMV sometimes is the root of the problem when you go and try and turn in information in DMV. Sometimes you may have all the information, they just take the name. And, you know, we should be trying to get all the information, and probably ultimately we need to figure out a way of changing the whole transfer system, I suspect. I know there are states that the plate stays with the person. That plate becomes yours for life, and you transfer that plate from vehicle to vehicle. Possibly in other scenarios that maybe the person that sells the vehicle needs to be responsible for making sure a transfer takes place. So that's the onus that you've put on the dealers and the towers. I can't sell a vehicle as a tower or a dealer without, if I haven't done registration or made sure that's done, we have to scrape the stickers or pull the plates. So, you know, we've tried to do those safeguards when industry is involved in doing that, but when the consumer sells the car, then everything's out the window and we don't have those safeguards any longer. So, as a representative of the Oregon Tow Truck Association, I'm not, we're not interested in pursuing people that don't owe their tow bills, but we certainly are interested in pursuing those people that really do. And whatever we can do to tighten this up is a good thing in my mind. It protects the consumer, and ultimately it's going to protect business that things are done properly and not, on the surface, this is a tragic case, and we don't want those sort of things to be coming out. So, thank you.
Question?
Representative Callan?
You're here, so I'm going to ask you the question.
Great.
Because what I heard the gentleman say was that the towing company had sold his vehicle for more than the towing charge. The subsequent was for storage and whatever. But what I just heard you say was that you couldn't sell it without the title. How is it that the towing company managed to sell the vehicle?
The vehicle, when a vehicle is abandoned at the tow yard, which happens in where I work, it happens about 50% of the time. 50% of the vehicles we tow are not picked up. So what happens is the lien process is instituted depending upon how it was towed, which criteria you use. But generally speaking, most cars that you tow can be towed within a 30-day lien process, or can be leaned within 30 days. And if it was towed as a PPI or a police tow and the person doesn't come forward and make contact with you, you have an obligation to request information within 5 business days. And then you have 48 hours after receipt of that information back from DMV to get your letters out in the mail. And the ultimate, there's another clause in the statute that says you have to make sure your mailer is out within 15 days. So those are the two, somewhere between 5 days and 15 days there's going to be a letter mailed and out to the registered owner. And if we have flag information, and I guess I should explain that because that question came up earlier. When you don't transfer the title, but you go in and give DMV information, that shows up on what's called a flag. And depending on how much information you have is that what the flag is classified as. Some flags have all information. Those are a...
Flag 49.
Flag 49 is one that's complete. A flag 13?
10.
A flag 10 is an incomplete flag. So, you know, you can go to 3 or 4 different DMV employees and you're going to get a different interpretation about what you should give and when you should give it and how soon. It would be wonderful if, you know, information was always accurate. Law enforcement doesn't... When they look at things, when they run a LEDS report, if an officer stops you on the street, he's going to go to the LEDS computer system to get his information. It doesn't tell them who the flag information is. It only gives them who registered owner and legal owner is. But once again, there's a disconnect. A law enforcement officer can't tell he can tell if there's a flag 49 or a flag 10, he knows that it's been sold, but he doesn't know who it's been sold to. So it's a difficult, everybody involved down the chain has a hard time getting accurate information. It's very frustrating for everybody involved. And not a perfect system by any means.
Well, thank you.
My name is Dina Kopp. I own Kopp's Towing, and I also own Dave's Auto Sales, which is a dealership in Banks, Oregon. And I'm the president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. One of the things I'd like to add is that DMV has become more proactive on trying to educate people that they do need to do that. I don't know that that was the case 8 years ago for Mr. Tosh, but now if you look at the back of a registration of your vehicle, it does have the information that they want on file, which is the new owner's name, driver's license number, address, and signature, saying that they've taken that, and then they want you to turn that registration in, and it does say to turn that in within 10 days. When they do that, that's very helpful. Today, I processed my liens just today, had a flag 49, which was that. So we went ahead and we notified the new buyer. I think a great way to clean up some of this language would be to add the flag system in there, because right now it does read registered owner, and that can be misinterpreted. I interpret that to be the person that it's been sold to. Other people could interpret that to be the original registered owner, because some people do not consider flags a legal transfer. Washington State requires that the seller transfer the vehicle. And if the seller does not transfer the vehicle to the new buyer, they just sell it to them and give them the paperwork, then they become financially responsible. But they know that because that's a statewide law, and they've got that on everything. It's printed on the title. It's printed everywhere on their website that you have to do that. So I think education to the consumer is huge.
Thank you. Representative Riley, question?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to follow up a little bit. You seem to know how it works in Washington, and so does the Washington motor vehicles, once they get that transfer, they mail out the new registration? How does that work?
What they do is they have a notice of transfer. It doesn't always transfer the title, but they do have various offices and people that act as agents for Washington DMV, where you can go in, and I believe it's a nominal fee, like $10 or $13, and you go in with the information and you put it on file. They do give you a receipt saying that you did that, and then that information is what they put out on their DMV records that they send out to the towers or law enforcement agencies that are asking.
So it's not a real transfer of title?
No, but it's considered a legal transfer at that point, because they went down and they paid and put that person's information on file.
Thank you. Appreciate your representative.
If I could have a quick question. Thanks. So help me understand. I think since there's no one here from DMV who can explain this to us. So when you sell a car to someone, say for $1,000, and you send information to DMV that you've sold this,
yes,
right? if they don't go into DMV to change the registration, then what happens?
Right now, the law is a little bit ambiguous. Myself, because you would send in the back of that registration, mm-hmm. or they also have a...
You would send it in, right?
I would send it in.
As the seller, okay.
If I sold the car, I would... Well, knowing that sometimes things fall through the cracks, I would probably go online and fill out what's called a 6890, which is a transfer of ownership that DMV has online, where I could print out a receipt that I did it. And I would also, as backup, mail in that copy of the registration that I had the buyer fill out, so that I would have proof that that was done. And then... If the car were towed, it would come up when they pulled the DMV report. It would say flag 49 on file, and then the next page that would follow would be the person who I sold the vehicle's information to. So my information would originally come up on the report. It would say vehicle registered owner Ladina Kopp, flag 49 on file would be under that. The next page would say I have a photocopy of the front and back of the registration. And it would have that person's information that they filled out on the back of the registration card.
Follow-up? So what happens if the buyer does not turn in their information to DMV, then what happens?
Turn in the information, there's no way to prove that they sold that vehicle.
There's no way you can prove that
there's
you
no,
sold,
right.
that, you sold it, that vehicle.
So if if the police came to me and said this car was involved in a hit-and-run...
Right.
What
you still the owner of that vehicle?
And I'm the owner, and they said, "Well, why didn't you notify DMV you sold it?"
Okay.
So then you'd have to go through a lot of proving.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony on this today. It's been helpful. So I'm sure we're going to have another conversation about this particular bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3151 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2141. Victoria, would you like to give us just a little summary of House Bill 2141? And I know that we have a couple of our an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2141 expands the definition of hazardous substance to include those that pose risk of irreversible or chronic adverse health effects, requires the Director of Human Services to adopt standards for labeling products that contain hazardous substances, and clarifies provisions related to misbranded hazardous substances.
And we have, the committee has dash one amendment, I believe?
Correct.
Wondering if I can get Gail Shibley to come up.
Mr. Chair, members.
Good afternoon. I was hoping that you'd be able to just briefly describe the dash one amendment to this bill and
Sure, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator for the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. As I had mentioned before, this bill is really attempting to get to a 21st century era issue that that we as a public health system around this country are working toward, and include in our longstanding authority of hazardous regarding hazardous substances to include substances that may cause irreversible harm or chronic adverse health effects. The amendment to House Bill 2141, I want to thank in particular, frankly, all the members who raised questions and issues. I thought that it was a very important and productive discussion at the initial hearing of the bill. Representative Barton, in particular, I think raised some very salient points and was quite clear to me that who wanted to make sure that, that this bill was not about getting after, my phrase now, getting after bad Big Macs or trans fats or any of the other kind of food items, if you will. And I really appreciate his leadership and focus on this issue. The bill, the amendment, rather, the dash ones that you've got, I think does just that. First, in response to Representative Barton's and I think a couple other members as well, concern that we add an F to section on the sub 7 that goes begins on page 2, I believe, of the dash ones, hazardous substance means. Originally, the bill had added an F to the sub A, B, C, D, E. Instead, working with Representative Barton, what we came up with was deleting that proposed new F and instead zeroing in quite more succinctly to, as I said, the longstanding authority that we have had, so that you see just a couple of lines there on page 2, lines 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the bill that, again, simply expand the current definition. The second thing that the bill, that the amendment does, sub 1, is on the beginning on the bottom of page 5, which is now section 2. So section 1 of the bill is a series of definitions. Section 2 then gets into amending ORS 453015, and that identifies areas that that the law does not reach. And just to be crystal clear, we added on the final line on page 5, line 30, that this statute does not apply to, I'm reading now on line 18, this statute does not apply to, and then skipping down to line 30, number 5, food or drugs, period. So we actually took words away, as Representative Barton had I think commented to me that I'd rather do this with fewer words rather than adding words, and so we changed this to just foods or drugs, period. We are clarifying, just to be completely very transparent about this, at the same time, however, ORS 453005 to 453135 and 990 sub 2, which is the enforcement piece of this, do apply to substances that come into contact with food, including but not limited to food packaging that could contaminate the food. That is to deal with issues that I think this committee has discussed in the past that has nothing to do with the Big Mac itself, for example. I'm not picking on Big Macs here, but if there were, I don't know, if it were wrapped in a lead lining, then we might be concerned about how that particular food product is packaged. And so that's what that language is intended to do.
Mr. Chair, do you want questions as we go along or hold them till the end?
Mr. Chair, I'm almost done, and then
let's
happy
let her
to
finish, please.
So then the third thing that the bill does is on beginning on page 6, and I just want to make sure. The bill does two more things, and I'll be brief here so we can get to questions. On pages 6 and 7 and most of 8, what the bill also does is, you may recall the original bill used the word product, and that was an error on our part initially. We instead went to labeling of articles. That's because our current statutory authority relates to articles, so we didn't want to add a different term into this current statute. So you'll see the phrase or the term article there. But pages 6 and 7 and most of 8 gets to articles containing substances which are meeting the definition that is in Section 1. So that's why you see the labeling of hazardous substances and for the labeling of articles that contain hazardous substances. As I mentioned before, that is, I suppose, simplistically put, the difference between buying a package of Drano, where the actual product you are purchasing, the article you are purchasing, is a hazardous substance, versus purchasing an article that that may contain, by dint of exposure, a hazardous substance. Finally, beginning on page 8 and then finishing on page 9 of the sub 1, which is, I think, section 4 of the bill, that sub 7, it makes sure that DHS is, I think, very appropriately constrained and focused on the weight of the scientific evidence. And so it very explicitly states that that DHS shall, in adopting any of these rules, review the scientific data, including, for example, laboratory findings, epidemiological studies, public surveillance, and consider whether the weight of the scientific evidence supports a finding that a substance is a hazardous substance. I mention that specifically both for, I think, its common sense impact, and also because I want to note for the committee's awareness that the weight of the scientific evidence is something that we in public health are very familiar with. For example, the established federal guidelines that are used, typically used in weight of the evidence assessments, include EPA guidelines on carcinogen risk assessment, neurotoxicity risk assessment, reproductive toxicity risk assessments, reference dose description and use in health assessments, benchmark dose technical guidance documents. So that really is a very much a scientific term of art. And a very well understood common currency, if you will, with which we are very familiar and very comfortable. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to try to clarify anything that I may have stated about these amendments.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop midway. It was where you were is where the question was the reason for the way I phrased that. So going back to page 6, the top about the substances that come into contact with foods, there's been quite a bit of conversation going around about how broad that interpretation might be. When I hear your description, I think about the wrapper that goes around my, I don't know, pound hamburger or whatever it is I'm buying. And the question has been raised to me, particularly related to the seafood industry, but I think it would apply to any shipping of basically bulk quantities of things and the plastic bins, that whether you're packing fish on ice or pears from the orchard, or I'm just sort of rattling off what comes to mind. I think maybe that begs some clarity there.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, this is intended to frame out what the potential scope could be. I'm certainly not going to identify, before going through the important rulemaking process, exactly what that kind of pencil-sharpened boundary might be. But I would put a lot of money on the fact that it wouldn't include things like bins of pears and so on. Rather, I'll pick on canned foods, for example. If you've got a canned food product that may be have polymer or elastin liners that sit for 6 months, a year, a couple years from the time that it's first manufactured to the time that it's eventually consumed. And if there is scientific weight, scientific evidence that indicates that degradation or leaching of some amount and type would result in that kind of, let me go back to the definition here now, irreversible harm or chronic adverse health effect, then it would reach, again, hypothetically, but potentially to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam Matthews?
Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. And for the panel and all the guests, I apologize. I have to be somewhere here briefly in the next 5 minutes with the governor, and I'm hopefully return. Just a couple of quick comments. I guess for me, we've talked. I'm very concerned about this. And when I read the bill, it's not so much the fact that we got an amendment now. It's just overall the concept. And I just want to lay this out, of course, before I step out, and I hope to return quickly. The food and packaging and that's a question that several people have, and I get that. I think for me it's the fact that it's about process. We have now, I think the pentabrominated diphenyl ether, octabrominated diphenyl ether, we're going to have a very potentially controversial another flame retardant coming before the committee. You know, with this bill, those things wouldn't come before the committee. It would just simply be a ruling in your office, and you'd be able to do and exercise full authority on whatever you did. And I think, quite honestly, and I recognize your service. You're a former state representative. I appreciate all of that. And it's not about that I don't trust you. It's the fact of, do we want to release that type of authority to that office? And then if we do make that decision, I think further, if I were to return in 2011, I don't know how we're not going to hear about somewhere in budget that there's a fiscal attached to the responsibility that your office would be charged with in terms of looking at all of these chemicals and digging deeper. And I know you're in it for the interest of the health and welfare of Oregonians, but I tend to think the process is best served, you know, in those coming before the committee, and the committee's making the ruling, then charging with how we go about that through your office. I don't necessarily think granting full authority to DHS is the right move at the right time currently. That's my concern, Mr. Chair. If I am back in time, I won't be supporting the Dash 1 amendments. I have a lot of concerns about it in general, but that's kind of where I'm at, and I just wanted you to know that for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Widener.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And Representative Matthews and Representative Cowan kind of got on it because, I mean, one of the pieces of language that really bugs me is the Director of Human Services shall adopt. Okay? To us, you should be coming and asking, hey, this is something we found, this is bad, and bringing in the doctors or scientists who say this is bad. And then substances that come into contact. I mean, one of the things we were talking about is plastic containers. Well, what about yogurt? What about, I mean, there's so many products that would, once you say, okay, we're going after this, well, now you got to include all of it because it all has it and it's all coming into contact with food at that point, and you've just pulled everything off the shelf without us making the decision. So, because once you say pick on one product and all of a sudden these other products are using the same chemical and the same plastic that they're using, you're opening the door for lawsuits against the whole state if you leave those others on. Wouldn't you be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I would... I appreciate your and everyone's very understandable and I think extremely healthy concerns and questions and skepticisms. Frankly, you may recall the very first time I appeared before this committee for a quick overview, I talked about where we need to get as a public health system and that I was looking forward to having this kind of discussion. I consider this, frankly, a win that we're continuing to talk about the potential health effects of subacute chronic exposures to chemicals. About 80,000 plus of them, very few of them are regulated by anybody. And we are playing, quite frankly, an enormous experiment in real life amongst ourselves and our children and generations to come. I simply cannot, as a public health official, in good conscience, allow that to continue without raising this from a precautionary principle to say that there are some real concerns. 2141 was pre-session filed by the governor on behalf of the department precisely because it's working within long-standing authority and framework. I appreciate your comment about, or perhaps it was Representative Matthews' comment, that would rather that this panel or a legislative panel see and hear and assess the scientific evidence of every molecular structure of every chemical among those 80,000. We are never going to get there if we do it that way. We simply cannot. And consequently, this is an effort to use the existing expertise that we have in epidemiologists, industrial hygienists, toxicologists, medical doctors, DVMs, and others that we have on staff in the public health division, and make sure that we are zeroing in on the highest priority. So I'm not going to pass judgment on potential legal liability. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to do that, but I wanted to make sure that it's clear from a policy standpoint. That's where I'm coming from as the office administrator of this department, and that's why we're here before you today.
And Ms. Sibley, I just want to point out or ask, I mean, you currently have this authority basically over hazardous substances when they cause acute adverse health impacts. And so,
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And so the liability issue wouldn't really be any different than what you already have. It's just that you're looking at a different, whether or not it has a long-term or adverse health impact. So
that's correct.
Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. People are commenting, and I want to do my comment. I don't believe that I'm in a position to micromanage. I think my job, is to set policy and hire experts who carry out that policy. And if I thought I understood microbiology, I might be inclined to look at all these issues. But what I believe, at least I want to do, is set policy and make sure that we have the experts who understand how to apply that policy.
Representative Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really do need to jump in because I think that my question was perhaps misinterpreted by some of my fellow members of this committee. And I want to make it really clear that the reason that I asked the question was to sort of try to clarify a little more about what we were talking about as opposed to the rumor mill that's running rampant. But at this point, I, with your indulgence, I have got to make a comment relating to what public health is and that we need to recognize and remember that the Ms. Shibley is here representing public health, and public health has always been the entity, or as long as we have recollection, the entity that ferreted out anything that might be there and might be of concern to the health of our general populace. My experiences go back to one of my first public health directors at the county level, and her start in public health was chasing rats in the city of Chicago at a time when, frankly, we didn't know that rats were that big a danger to us. But thankfully, we've come a little ways since then, and I want to reiterate that this really is not a different standard for what public health does. It is a process of examining the evidence there. It does take it to beyond just what makes you sick today into what might be a chronic problem. I have not been terribly supportive of all of the bills on this subject that have come before us, but I've always been supportive of this one. And the reason is because I really want somebody smarter than me to look at all of that evidence that's there and to read those scientific documents, because I've been trying to wade through them, and I think that's not the job of the layperson, and it most certainly isn't the job of a legislative committee to try to figure out what each and every product and the scientific data on it says to us. So I want to make sure that my question was not misinterpreted and how I feel about this issue.
Thank you. Representative Wingard was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a specific question first, and then I'd like to join in on the commenting. But my question goes back to page 6 that Representative Cowan was talking about. Back to this language of does not apply to substances that come into contact with foods. And I realize that previous to that, sub 3, pesticides are listed. But I'm wondering if that line about pesticides includes all pesticides. And if it doesn't, then does that language open the department up to beginning to make evaluations about chemicals that come into contact with foods at the farm level, which I think would be a whole new set of responsibilities for the department.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, thank you for that question. It's a really insightful one, and I appreciate the opportunity for this clarification. As you point out, on page 5 of the bill, section 2, which is the what is not covered by this statute, and then the sub 3 that's on line 26, pesticides subject to FIFRA, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or by state equivalent statutes. So the quick answer is that FIFRA and state statutes require trained commercial operators use pesticides that are regulated by the federal and state government. And so that covers anything that is bought, sold legally, used legally, period. It's a blanket exemption.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Okay, so then to the discussion that's mostly at hand, which, you know, I'm looking at this language on page 8 and 9. And first of all, I want to agree with Representative Cowan. I mean, we want somebody looking at this. I guess my concern is that what we're adding in requires, first of all, it's contentious. I mean, this, my personal experience, just from a public policy standpoint, of listening to discussions over these types of issues, and even what we've been dealing with phthalates and things like that, is that it's contentious. And I think this is expensive. And so I guess I'm making two arguments. I'm expressing two concerns. One is that I think this taking this on from a state level is really, it seems to me, going to be an expensive process. Secondly, again, agreeing with Representative Cowan that we want somebody looking at that, I think we do have somebody looking at it. We have a number of federal agencies that spend a great deal of money and have large budgets going over these kinds of issues. And nothing that would be examined by the state of Oregon isn't a product that isn't also sold in another state and is therefore subject to this federal investigation by the various agencies that look at this. So I think we're being duplicative at our own expense to some degree. But they seem to me to have the money and the resources to spend the time and a lot of time going through a lot of information. I don't think we have the money and resources to do that here and to be basically duplicative. I think that what happens when the feds go through that process, it gets litigated. There's a tremendous amount of economic interest involved, obviously, and so there's a lot of money spent one way or another. That whole process then suddenly is going to start happening, you know, here, which I just can't imagine we want to invite on ourselves. And lastly, I'd say that I am much more comfortable with agencies at the federal level who have the time and the vast resources to sift through this, coming to a decision than I am with this language, which essentially is going to make Oregon's Director of Human Resources, or I'm sorry, the Health Department, Department of Human Services, is going to be the final say on these issues. And I'll even disagree with my colleague, Representative Widener, that I don't think we're probably qualified to be sitting here and passing judgment on that. But I would also say that I am dubious about the idea that that Oregon's Director of Human Services is qualified enough to be making those kinds of decisions. So, I think this is a bill with a tremendous impact. I agree with you that it's an important discussion to be having, but I just think there's a lot of cost here that we're not fully thinking through that will come with Oregon beginning this kind of a process.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Representative Wingard, thank you for your comments and your perspectives. I appreciate that. And I appreciate what I think I heard you say as your support for an environmental public health budget. Unfortunately, environmental public health receives very little percentage of general fund. The general fund that is received is used as a partial state match for millions of federal dollars for safe drinking water oversight. But and about 80% of my budget is federal money, so I'm very familiar with what goes on at the federal government. They pay most of for what happens within my purview, and I'm very tuned into them. I wanted to address just a couple pieces. One is that this is a state-federal partnership. In that way, it is really very similar to, if not precisely the same as, many efforts that we in Oregon and other states deal with, whether it's around food safety or around radiation protection or around surveillance of cyanobacteria in recreational waters or beach monitoring or a variety of other things where the federal government sets a floor, if you will, and states are free to be more protective of public health if they so choose. That's what we can do in safe drinking water. That's what we can do under the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and other things that with FIFRA and other programs. In terms of chemical exposures, I am already, and my office and this division and therefore the Department of Human Services is already very engaged with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, their Agency for Toxic Registry and Disease, ATSDR, Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and National Center for Environmental Health, the National Institute of Environmental Health, the National Institutes of Health, a variety of Department of Health and Human Services agencies around this issue. So this is not, although our state motto is she flies with her own wings, we are not attempting to fly on our own wings here at all. Quite the opposite, in fact. Oregon is among nine states around the country, including those sparsely populated states of California and New York, who are very assiduously, very methodically, very thoroughly working together as states and working in partnership with the federal government to identify and assess and prioritize those substances which continue to move into the red, move the needle into the red column, so to speak, in terms of concern from a public health standpoint. And so, again, we are not flying with our own wings there. We are working in hand-in-glove collaboration with Massachusetts, Michigan, Maine, Washington, California, New York, Connecticut, a variety of states representing a fairly significant slice of the country. No one has any interest in or patience for or otherwise involvement in setting standards or taking actions that are contrary to or inconsistent with or otherwise not in keeping with what other states and what the federal government is doing. So My last point is this is not an effort. I think I perhaps have shared with you in the past. As environmental public health public administrators and specialists, really all we have is our scientific credibility. We guard it religiously. That is the coin of our realm, and we are not interested in some wild-eyed agenda of grabbing this issue du jour or that issue du jour. We take it extremely seriously, and consequently, we don't anticipate, and I do not anticipate, I've worked with my program managers, my budget managers, and others, in trying to really identify the frequency, the size, the scope, the scale of this additional update of our authority. And we do not anticipate using this very often. We do not anticipate having to use this very often. But we need to begin to reset this paradigm in a way that truly captures the public health risks for this century.
Thank you. I'm going to dispense with the questions for you at this point. I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Appreciate the governor bringing this issue forward, and appreciate your testimony to this point. I do have quite a few things left on the agenda, so I am going to start moving on a little bit quicker. And I know there's a few people signed up on this bill. I'm going to let them come up and speak real briefly. If they have written testimony, they can turn that on. Turn that in. I've got Matt Marquis, Erica Hagedorn, Greg Peden, and Terry Witt. Welcome. To the committee, if you could identify yourself for the record and hopefully keep your comments to about 3 minutes, it would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the American Chemistry Council. I will be brief because I just saw the Dash 1 amendments, and so I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they say. My first glance, I don't think these help our position. I think we are still definitely opposed to the Dash 1 amendments. I'm not sure that there's a huge difference between the word article and product. And while this does put in some language on the last couple of pages dealing with scientific evidence, I'm still not really sure what that means. It says they shall review scientific data, which may include, doesn't have to include all of these things, but may include that. Our basic principle here is we don't think that that the legislature should be delegating this authority to a state agency. As mentioned by the previous witness, pesticides are exempt out of this, and I'm not advocating that they shouldn't be, but apparently they are exempt because they're regulated under federal law. And I would say that a lot of chemicals, or all chemicals, are regulated under federal law, and we have a variety of different acts that have passed through Congress regulating a whole variety of this stuff. And so I'm not sure that Oregon should be in the place of banning certain types of articles, chemicals, whatever the case may be, and that this is more a federal issue that should be looked at as a whole rather than piecemeal by state by state. I also gave you, just for your information, to read at your leisure, an article that was done by NPR just last week that I think speaks pretty well to this issue about science and legislatures and how the intertwine mixes. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to let my colleagues here talk, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll try also to be brief. I think we have two major concerns with the concept of this bill. I guess, number one, whenever I look at a piece of legislation, the first thing I ask is, what is or where is the documented problem that we're trying to solve? And I guess I would have to ask that question with regard to this piece of legislation. What is the problem, and has it been documented to really be a problem, or is it a problem of perception? When I look at the bill, having some training in the technical arena, the first thing that really grabbed me was their definition of a hazardous material. Their definition really is not a definition of hazard. It's a definition of a chemical characteristic. They're talking about things being toxic, corrosive, combustible, etc. Those are chemical characteristics. They are not the hazard rating of a chemical. Hazard is a combination of its innate toxicity or ability to do harm plus or times the exposure. So you can have an extremely toxic material, no exposure, and your hazard is very, very low. Consequently, you can have a very low toxicity material, like table salt, for example. If you have a high enough exposure, it can be extremely hazardous. The lethal dose of common table salt is about 40 grams for an adult. That's smaller than the average salt shaker on a table. Obviously, we don't ingest that at one time, but if we did, it could be lethal. So you have this kind of a situation where hazard is really a combination of both the innate characteristics of the material and exposure. The other thing is, we've got a lot of materials that cross an awful lot of boundaries, and the one that really popped into mind as a substance is something like ethanol. You can drink it. It's a beverage. It's a solvent. It's also a fuel. That's going to be found in a lot of places. It's also extremely toxic. So I think we have to look at the basic premise of how they were characterized things. The other thing what I found extremely disturbing was the comment that was just made by Administrator Shibley when she stated that what we need to do is exercise the precautionary principle. That is a very dangerous principle to adopt as a policy for a state. In essence, what that says, the precautionary principle says that zero is the only acceptable risk, and that is unattainable. The other thing that it does is it forces you into a situation where you're asking people from a scientific perspective to prove a negative, that something doesn't exist or something doesn't have a negative effect. That is also another impossibility. I'll close with, I think, commenting a little bit on a statement that was just made. We have literally thousands of scientists and toxicologists at the federal level who are very, very specialized in their field of expertise, that look at these chemicals, that regulate these chemicals, that spend years looking at data to determine whether or not the data is good data or poor data, to determine whether any additional regulation needs to be put on the product in terms of mitigation for hazard to humans. And now we're saying that we are going to recreate this kind of a regulatory framework at the state of Oregon and expect the Department of Human Services to have that level of expertise. It seems like a rather wasteful use of our limited resources. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't let that go without at least one comment. And that, when you say that precaution is not where we want to go, that worries me a lot, because if we don't do precaution, then we're doing reaction. And I certainly don't want to be in the reactionary business. So I'm when I hear someone say you don't want us to do precautionary work, that confuses me a lot. Could you explain what you mean?
Chair Hovey, Representative Riley, I think you're confusing precautionary with proactive. I'm not saying we shouldn't be proactive. Precautionary says that if you have a risk, you're not going to do it. That's typically the mantra that happens. And again, zero risk is unattainable. I'm not saying you shouldn't look at things and use due caution based on good science.
Oh, well, good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, thank you.
Just snuggle up here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Erica Hagedorn here today on behalf of the Northwest Food Processors Association and the Oregon Metals Industry Council. to echo the comments of Matt Marquis, we remain opposed to the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. We feel at the very base level, this is a wide open door and actually lowering the bar for the items that DHS can deem hazardous to the public health. We're concerned that there's still no fiscal on the bill. This is obviously a large endeavor that they want to pursue, and we feel like that there should be state resources behind this if they're going to take a look and undertake this large, serious look at research on certain chemicals that we're concerned that there's no fiscal. I'm going to talk specifically about the food packaging piece on page 6 at the top, lines 1 through 3. I've talked to several of you on the committee. I think people need to realize that your bag of frozen peas, that bag that you throw in your freezer, has phthalates in it. Any lining for a canned food, or if you have a jar of applesauce, some of the lining is going to be BPA. I talked about previously in my testimony when this bill first came up, the ink on the packaging of a yogurt cup, that could potentially have BPA or other substances that DHS is looking to regulate. Also the lid on a yogurt cup, it could contain some sort of metal or other element that DHS feels is somehow hazardous to the public. What food processors and also metals industry folks on a commodity side would like you to consider is that under this bill, DHS could tell members of the third largest manufacturing sector in Oregon, which is food processing, that they could ban their product, they'd have to reformulate it, or it'd have to be labeled with warning or caution without giving the consumer more information about the exposure level, like Terry was mentioning, or what kind of hazard is actually involved in eating the yogurt, eating the applesauce, taking your peas out of the freezer. We feel like this could completely halt production in some plants if you have to reformulate what packaging you're using in your food that is already regulated by the FDA. So we'd urge you to look at the science and address these issues. DHS already has the authority to address the most serious life-threatening issues that they'd like to do. But we don't think that you should hand over these serious economic decisions to DHS. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Peden. I'm here this afternoon representing Pacific Seafood. A lot of the issues that I wanted to raise have been said, so I'll be brief as possible. Representative Cowan referenced the conversation that she and I had about, I think, the widespread implications for the fishing industry in Oregon for this in relationship to the packaging crates that seafood is put on ice and packaged through, both for processors but also for the individual fishermen. It's simply the packaging that moves the product around through the supply line. But the Dash 1 amendments, I think, actually would go even further than that. And I'll give you what I think is an example, and I think this is important because of the conversation about, are we talking about those type of products or are we talking about individual wrappers? Fishing boats. Most fishing boats, either commercial or sport fishing boats, are made of plastic polymers. All of those fishing boats have holds in them where you pack ice and pack your catch. And they all contain all those polymers, all contain all of these chemicals as well. And sometimes those fish or ocean products that are caught would spend a longer time in those holds in those boats than they would on a shelf in a Safeway. You know, we might be on a 3-day or longer fishing trip, but I get back to port, the thing is shipped, packaged, shipped, processed, and then might sit on a shelf in a Safeway for a day or two before it's bought. So I understand that we have maybe saying, well, that's not really our intent, or we wouldn't do that. But I think the language, it's very clear that Erica referenced, certainly would impact that extent of our industry. And so for those type of reasons, we think this is extremely broad-reaching language, and we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. I'm not seeing
one little question.
Representative Krieger.
We're talking about the commercial fishing boats, and that there's a lot of products, the shovels, plastic, the totes that the product goes into are of a whole different variety taken into a cool room, stored a day or two, or shipped. Often the product is partially processed and then put back into a plastic, what the flesh is opened to the plastic and ice. The storage plant that the ice come out of has these same chemicals and different plastic parts that go through the ice machine. The shrimp peeling machine, the fillet machine, all of them have these same type of products. Surface that you do the fillet on is out of a polymer. I mean, there's no end to this stuff. Where it is.
Thank you. Just a comment. I don't believe, though this bill has broad-reaching language, perhaps the department has this authority for acute effects already, and certainly I don't see anything in this bill that basically says that all those polymers are going to be outlawed by DHS overnight. I recognize there's a tremendous amount of fear out there on these issues in this bill, but certainly I think there's a lot of concern out there as well for consumers for some products that may be quite hazardous, and certainly we're seeing remnants of that being imported from China into our market. So I do recognize that there's a problem out there. Mr. Witt was wondering where the problem was, and we read about it every day in the newspaper, it seems. Just make that comment. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2141. And I'm going to open a public hearing on... Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2792. And Victoria, would you briefly go over that bill with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2792 requires manufacturers of children's products that contain priority chemicals, as designated by the Department of Human Services based on potential exposure of children and fetuses, to disclose information on their use to the department. Allows department to require use of safer alternative where available, exempt specified uses of priority chemicals, and imposes civil penalties for violation. Authorizes the department to participate in interstate clearinghouse, establishes Environmental Public Health Protection Fund, and continuously appropriates monies to the department for purposes of the act.
Thank you. First, I'd like to have Renee Heckenmiller. Committee, I believe we've received some amendments on this bill, and my hopes is Ms. Heckenmiller will be able to
enlighten you.
Tell us a little bit about these amendments to this bill.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Renee Heckenmiller Paradis, and I'm the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 2792-1, and before you, there are several amendments for your consideration. Just real briefly, I want to let you know what I've put in my testimony packet. There's been a lot of concern about how 2792 would actually work, and I was hoping to provide you with some information on actually what is involved in the process. And so I've created a very nice, colorful diagram for you that's in your testimony packet that walks you through what our intent is with 2792 as a process. I know for sake of time, I'm not going to go through it. If you want me to, I can at some point. And then there's also attached to that a more narrative description. Some of you are visual, some of you are narrative. I wanted to give you that to explain again what the intent we saw was behind 2792. And then finally, I included an article on what the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse is and what it, upon formation, would be enable states and the partner states to do with the information contained in that Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse. I'm happy to take any questions about any of those handouts, but quickly go through the amendments that are before you for consideration, if that's...
If you would.
So HB, the DAS-2 amendments Well, Dash 1 amendments added DEQ to participating in this process. The Dash 2 amendments, which are before you here, clarify what we meant by safer alternatives assessment and added economic feasibility and technical performance to consideration of looking at those alternatives for substitution. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments do. And then also for your consideration are Dash 3 amendments, and that actually would remove the entire Section 6 and 7, which looks at those safer alternatives. So in effect, if you adopted the Dash 3 amendments, you would end up with a process that has DHS and DEQ identifying chemicals of concern, requiring manufacturers to disclose that information, and then participating in the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse. Now, it's a lot of information right there, so I'll give you a minute to digest. I'm happy to take any questions or elaborate. I do want to remind you that HB 2792 in all the amended versions isn't about labeling or banning. It's about getting information to inform our public health process. I want to point out the integral central role of the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse, which Gail mentioned. There's a large number of states participating in that, and that really will allow us to get through some of the hurdles that have been brought up about the capacity of DEQ and DHS to have this information. The Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse is meant to be a repository of and collaboration amongst states and experts on what are the toxic impacts, what are the exposures, what are safer alternatives that could be available for any of these chemicals we might look at.
Does the federal government participate in some way in that Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse?
Representative Holdy, at this time it's a state government entity, and it actually would be run similar to an entity that exists for mercury. It's called IMERC. It's an international, interstate group that looks at mercury issues. So it would be housed as a nonprofit run by state agencies, would be sitting on that board, and then there would be a process to involve other concerned stakeholders, but the decision-making process would be governed by the state agency participants.
Thank you. Questions on the amendments?
Just one.
Krieger.
You said the Dash 2 adds DEQ, or is it Dash 1?
Dash 1 adds DEQ.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Tomei.
So, am I understanding that you have proposed all three of these amendments and you're supporting all three of the amendments?
Chair Holdy, Representative Tomei, we would support the little Dash 2. A Dash 3 essentially takes out what would supersede Dash 2. So we're submitting all of them for your consideration.
Say that again. So
Dash 3 would supersede Dash 2 because Dash 3 removes Section 6 and 7, which is altered in Dash 2.
Thank you.
And in addition, if I may, there are some additional changes to Dash 3 that reduce some of the penalties. Representative Barton actually could probably speak better to those if he had a chance. But it, essentially, there were some duplicative penalties associated with the original draft, and the Dash 3 amendments would get rid of some of that duplicity.
Thank you. Representative Krieger?
Just a comment. DEQ recently got new authority regarding the gravel mining, along with Division of State Lands, Corps of Engineers, Federal Fish and Wildlife, and when they got involved, it turned into a bureaucracy beyond anything that anyone ever envisioned, and is costing literally thousands and thousands of dollars to get permits, having to hire every kind of a specialist you can, even though you've met the criteria of all these federal agencies and other state agencies. And bringing this agency into anything, I think we better be careful what the ramifications of that might be.
Thank you for the comment.
I like DEQ.
Representative Winger, question?
Are we being asked to adopt 1 and 3? And if, well, whether the answer is yes or no, I think I understand 1 because we were given some, but what does 3 do?
Thank you for remaining here after your question.
somebody else ask one and go.
So, I think that my intent was to have these amendments. We're not in work session. We're not moving these amendments. My intent was to, these amendments all came out, so I wanted the committee to have a chance to look at these and to explain them. It's my understanding that the dash ones are relatively separate. The dash twos provide, an amendment to the bill along with the dash ones. And then the dash threes basically eliminate sections 6 and 7, which would make the dash twos kind of meaningless. And so I think if this bill were to move forward, we'd be looking at the dash ones and the dash threes, or the dash ones and the dash twos. So there's kind of two options there in front of you for the amendments. Sam Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we have Representative Barton explain the dash threes since he helped draft those?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't believe I've conferred with some potential amendments and concerns of the bill, but to say I drafted the dash threes I think would be a significant overstatement. I have not seen them actually. I still haven't.
They're somewhere in this plan.
Yeah. Thank you.
I didn't ask for a comment, Representative Burton. I
just saw the penalties on there and stuff. Yeah. So
I don't see any other questions on these amendments. I just wanted the committee to have these in front of them. So we've had Ms. Hackenmiller explain them to us, essentially what they are. So I think you've done a good job of bringing us two options, it looks like, for this bill, and I appreciate your bringing them forward and your work on this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
In an effort to achieve the goal that you wanted, I don't understand what the two options are that we're being offered here. So if the idea was for the committee members to understand, I would like to know what it is we're being offered here.
So, Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, so dash one and dash two together, that would leave the bill essentially as it is, adding some, adding DEQ to the bill, and then dash two would give clarification to what is meant by a safer alternative, including economic feasibility and technical aspects of evaluating a safer alternative. So that's what the dash one and dash two would do. The dash one, well, dash one's still a thing. Dash three actually would remove the assessment, the safer alternatives assessment piece. If you look on my handy dandy little colored chart here, it would remove this piece of it right here. So it would not, the part of the process would, that we're asking DHS and DEQ to go through would not include a safer alternatives assessment. It would not ask them, it would not ask manufacturers to replace chemicals that are found to have safer alternatives through this process.
Follow up. So if that was removed, they would disclose and that would be the end of the process?
Representative Holby, Representative Wingard. Yes, they would disclose. So then we would have information to inform the public health process. Perhaps one could imagine using that information that was acquired through manufacturer disclosure to come back to the legislature and ask for substitution, regulation, or some further process.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. And I appreciate you helping us out understanding these amendments as well.
Thank you, Chair Holby.
Thank
you. If there's any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Committee, I'm assuming that you all got a copy of the letter from the DEQ on this bill as well, in support of this bill. And next up, I have Matt McKee, Jim Craven, and Terry Witt again. Yeah. You can be extremely brief. You don't need to repeat your testimony from the previous bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Craven on behalf of Tech America, the nation's largest high-tech trade association.
I won't repeat because I didn't speak on the other one. So. But a lot of my notes have been mentioned already. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you, in the couple times that we've heard these bills, have drilled down to the real nut of the question here. It is an uncomfortable position when you represent industry to come in and oppose a bill that's being touted as necessary to protect our children. That's a duality that I don't think exists, and the fact that we have questions about the bill in no way means we're on the other side of protecting children from the OEC and the Division of Health. That should be obvious, but I think sometimes it just needs to be said. When we represent clients who are engaged in global, national commerce, they ask us to ask the what-ifs, not the trust-me's type of questions. All our clients can do is read the words that are printed on the page, and they look through it section by section by section. They don't say, oh, this is a children's health bill, so I guess that's cool. They say, what about Section 2? What about Section 3? What about Section 6? I mean, that's the feedback we get. And I think I'm pleased to see that we've made some progress here in the Dash 3s, as to the best I can understand it. A few more pages and we'll be in good shape. And I think the issue here, and you've heard it on this bill and the previous bill, the issue of delegation of authority, that makes people nervous. Let's be real honest with it. The bill that you heard before provides the Health Division with what I like to call the nuclear option. Allows the state of Oregon to ban your product from sale in this state. When we say we would like that the people's elected people to have some skin in that game, that's what we mean. I mean, this is not even just a warning label. It's your product cannot be sold in Oregon. Thank you very much. Move on. When we looked at this bill and the words of it, and I looked at it again today, and I hadn't looked at it a lot since our last hearing, we've got a definition. I think Mr. Witt spelled this out for you. We've got a definition that defines priority chemicals based upon their constituents. I mean, there's chlorine will kill you, and there's chlorine in the water I drink every day in Salem. This bill does not make that connection in the language that I read here between causes in this exposure, in this substance, in this form. So we get our chemicals listed, and then what the bill says, every global manufacturer who uses that chemical in any level that could be in a product sold in Oregon has to send you all a letter and tell you that that's what we do. And that's what the bill says. And then it says, and we can pay a fee also to help them accumulate all this data and add it all up. It is an enormous bill before you. And I think the role of lobbyists is to go through all the words, read all the pages, and bring you our specific concerns. Not our concern as to whether we support children's health, but our concerns about all the sections in the bill and the implications to our clients. This is a massive undertaking that's spelled out in this bill. It is massive. Every global producer of a product with a chemical that gets put on this list must disclose that to the state of Oregon and notify every seller in Oregon of their product of that chemical. Now, I was going to talk about Oregon also telling
us... Could you wrap it up in about 10 seconds, please?
I was also going to mention the part about Oregon telling us how to redesign our chemicals and substitute. I guess that's being removed. But I still think this is an enormous task. I think it's duplicative of the proper place where this ought to happen, which is at the federal level. And I don't think the resources that are being asked for this are sufficient to do what is a massive undertaking. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, American Chemistry Council. I did hand out to you a lot of paperwork, some of which you probably already have, but I did want to make all of that on the record for the committee. There were a lot of questions asked at the last hearing on this and other bills. It's all addressed there of the questions that were asked of our panel at that time. I don't want to reiterate what Jim just said, but I do want to focus on what the federal government is doing. And if this is some information information that Oregon is really interested in, I think we need to focus on what the federal government is doing. And the Chemical Assessment and Management Program currently, right now, under this program, the U.S. EPA is completing a screening level and risk characterizations to prioritize and initiate actions as appropriate on more than 6,750 chemicals, which are produced at 25,000 pounds per year. This is a risk-based prioritization, which will summarize basic hazards and exposures on information on high and medium volume production chemicals, identifying potential risks, notifying scientific issues and uncertainties, and initiate and indicate the initiative priority being assigned by the agency. So this is stuff that is currently happening on the federal level, and I think we should look there rather than trying to use our resources and duplicating the process.
Thank you. Mr. Witt.
Chair Hopley, members of the committee, Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I won't cover any of the bases that have already been covered. I have one very specific concern, particularly in light of pesticides and pesticide registrations. I always find it confusing when in the definitions section they embed two or three other definitions. For example, when they talk about children's product, then you have to look to see what consumer product is, because that's part of the definition. But it's really important, I think, that it's noted that children's product does not necessarily have to be a product designed for children. It is a product that a child could come in contact with during its use or its disposal. That's a very, very important distinction to understand. The other concern that I have, as I said before, is one specifically related to pesticides. I know it says in here that a consumer product, that they do not include a product that is regulated by the United States EPA as a pesticide. However, it says, except that consumer products may include the container or packaging in which such an item is sold. So while they can't change the formulation of the pesticide, the way I read it, they can tinker with what the pesticide is packaged in. And that is also a regulated act by the U.S. EPA, because they have to make sure that the container, you know, does not adversely react with the product or vice versa, that it's obviously suitable to contain that product, which is toxic and you don't want to get out into the environment, and requires a registration process in and of itself. So it's not something that can be quickly or easily modified without some pretty significant cost in research to the registrant and time to get it reapproved by the U.S. EPA.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony. I appreciate your concerns, and I know your concern for your industry. I just want you to know there's others out there that have concerns too about what's in our products. And you know, global commerce aside, you know, we don't really want to impede global commerce, but at the same time, when we read in our papers of the dangerous products that are coming into this country, it gives us pause, you know, to think that there should be something being done about that. And I think this conversation is part of that concern, and I think industry needs to recognize that, because global commerce hasn't done anything about stopping those products from getting here. So, and neither is the federal government, quite frankly.
Mr. Chair?
So with that, I thank you for your comments, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2792. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2578, and I'd like to come up. Who are the people coming up?
Representative Riley is
going to
go through the amendments
first. Al Elkins, Gaylene Cooper, and Mike Wagner. And Representative Riley, would you like to describe the amendment that we're looking at on this bill?
I would be happy to do that.
Briefly
is difficult on this amendment, but I'll do my best. We had a couple of work sessions to get this amendment done. This is very much a consensus amendment. This bill has worked out. What it does, I'll go through it very quickly. In Section 1, it says that anytime a vehicle is towed, there must be a photograph, and it must prove that the vehicle is in violation and therefore should be towed. And they have to retain that photograph. In Section 2, it says that the tower may not tow a motor vehicle from a parking facility without first contacting the owner of the facility's owner or agent. Or it may not tow a vehicle from a parking facility if the parking facility's owner or agent is an employee of a tower. And you'll see that it talks about, except as provided in subsection 3. Subsection 3 says, if the...
Could you give us the line, Representative?
Yeah, I'm trying to go through very quickly, but where I was talking about was on page 3, line 7. And that talks about the fact that they can't tow without contact, and that the agent of the owner may not be employed by a towing company. There are exceptions to that, and the exceptions are the tower may tow a motor vehicle if it blocks, prevents access of by emergency vehicles, access to the premises, blocks a motor vehicle, or parks without parking facility in a facility used for residences or apartment where there are more residential units than parking spaces. And this gets complicated, but what we're talking about is, in those particular cases, there are more potential residents than parking spaces, so we can't assign the parking spaces. So they give tags, and in this case only, towers are allowed to tow without contact with an agent of the facility, but they still have to have a contract that spells out how that's going to work, and you still have to do a photograph.
And committee, my intention is to move to work session pretty quick and adopt this amendment. We will have another opportunity to go through this bill. We're not working the bill today, but I did want to go ahead and get this adopted to facilitate our future work on Friday.
Yeah.
So with that, Representative Riley, I'd like the panel to get a chance to state something in the next 3 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. First of all, we'd like to thank Representative Riley for the two meetings that we had. One of his colleagues from this committee pointed a finger at him at the end of the second one and said, "You are brave." And I think that pretty much sums up the work that he did with us. We all reached a consensus on this, and we greatly appreciate all the time he put in and the other committee members did. Thank you.
I'm just here for window dressing.
Well, introduce yourself for the record.
Mike Wagner. I'm with the I'm a board member of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I own a towing company up in Lyons, Oregon. So.
And I assume that you are also in consensus in support of this -2 amendment.
Yeah, I think it was a very fair compromise for all parties involved, and everybody was at the table. Representative Riley did a great job of mediating a result. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Galen Cooper. I'm a consumer. I'd like to express my thank you for letting me be a part of the committee. I think the proposed amendment that we made with House Bill 2578 is a win-win situation for everyone involved. The committee was made up with different people of the industry. We had the property management industry, tow truck association or industry, as well as myself as a consumer. And I can tell you as a consumer, I am very well pleased. I feel that we were very much represented, and it's a good thing for everyone. And I think that the next step will be education for everyone, property managers as well as tow truck drivers and tow truck companies and tenants.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578 and open a work session on House Bill 2578.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2578.
Representative Riley moves the -2 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2578. Discussion? Seeing none. Is there any
objections
to moving the -2 amendments? Seeing none, the -2 amendments are adopted into House Bill 2578. With that, I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2578.
Carry it over.
And I will carry House Bill 2578 over until Friday. With that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Good job.
Too late.